This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tom Jenkins. As he described current levels of vaccine inequity as grotesque, the head of the World Health Organization said more producers of COVID-19 vaccines should follow the example of AstraZeneca and license their technology to other manufacturers. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus noted the drug maker's interim data from trials found in the vaccine developed in conjunction with Oxford University was 79% effective in preventing symptomatic COVID-19 and crucially posed no increased risk of blood clots. The data showed the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine was safe and effective. Germany extended its lockdown measures by another month and imposed several new restrictions, including largely shutting down public life over Easter in an effort to drive down the rate of coronavirus infections. Chancellor Angela Merkel announced the measure early Tuesday after a lengthy video call with the country's 16 state governors. Nearly 3 weeks after the two sides last agreed on a plan for paving the way to relax some rules, and then infections have increased steadily as the more contagious variant, first detected in Britain, has become dominant. Airlines and other tourism-related businesses are pushing the White House to draw up a plan in the next 5 weeks to boost international travel and eliminate restrictions that were imposed early in the pandemic. More than two dozen groups made their request in a letter to the White House on Monday. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. At least 10 people are dead, including a police officer, after a shooting in the U.S. state of Colorado. We get more from AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
It was at a King Superstore in Boulder, Colorado. District Attorney Michael Dougherty.
This is a tragedy and a nightmare.
Police Commander Kerry Yamaguchi.
We have multiple people who were killed in this incident. And I am sorry to have to report that one of them was a Boulder police officer.
They believe there was only one gunman, and officers could be seen taking the man out in handcuffs with no shirt and blood running down his legs. Witnesses described seeing people face down. KMGH spoke to this man, who heard the tragedy unfolding.
Big bang.
And then,
probably 3 seconds before he heard another, it's like bang, 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 bang.
He says he and his wife ran to an emergency door, then he helped other shoppers escape from the store. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The Biden administration continues to face more questions about its secrecy at the southern border regarding the influx of migrants and detainment policies of people, especially children. At a news conference Monday, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the administration is finalizing details on allowing reporters to visit the border facilities.
We're going to give you access to the facilities so that the press can have access themselves.
And she adds the U.S. is telling migrants not to try to enter.
There's no change in policy. The border remains closed. Families and single adults are being expelled under Title 42 and should not attempt to cross illegally.
The administration released some images and videos Monday that show immigrant teenagers sleeping on mats in crowded conditions, separated in groups by plastic partitions. The administration steadfastly refuses to call the detention of more than 15,000 children in U.S. custody a crisis, but it has stymied most efforts by outsiders to decide for themselves. The European Union and the United States imposed sanctions Monday on a number of Myanmar officials accused of involvement in the country's military coup and the ensuing crackdown on protesters. The EU announced penalties on 11 officials, including 10 top military officers, most of whom had already been sanctioned by the U.S. The Biden administration, meanwhile, targeted two senior officials, including the national police chief. Last month's coup reversed years of slow progress towards democracy in Myanmar. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daybreak Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Congo-Brazzaville opposition candidate in Sunday's election has died.
Everyone can see the legacy of Parfait Kolela, saying that I'm dying, but you need to go to vote, not for me, but go to vote to change the overall political game in the country.
African leaders paid tribute to the late Tanzanian President John Magufuli. Officials say more than 3 million children are out of school in Nigeria. Disabled, internally displaced people suffer disproportionately in Burkina Faso. And the United Nations says the humanitarian crisis in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province could negatively impact the surrounding regions.
In terms of what's actually been happening, villages have been set on fire, people killed, beheaded, including children, or reports of children being beheaded, rape, and of course, huge levels of sexual violence of one kind or another.
And Lusa Africa, a record label, finds new markets amid COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Some supporters of Congo-Brazzaville's opposition candidate in Sunday's presidential election, Guy Brice Parfait Kolela, says Sunday's election results should be cancelled. This follows Mr. Kolela's sudden death after falling ill and was airlifted to France. President Denis Sassou Nguesso, in power for 36 years, is expected to win re-election. George Goma is a member of the North American Platform Against Dictatorship in Congo-Brazzaville. He says the late Kolela was an admired political leader who fought for change in Congo-Brazzaville.
My first reaction is sadness, because Parfait Kolela was the leading opponent in the election that is taking place right now. He was the greatest opposition leader, so that made me very sad to hear that he passed away. And everyone in our country saw that video, is going viral on social media. Everyone can see the legacy, finally, the legacy of Parfait Kolela, saying that I'm dying, but you need to go to vote. Go and vote, not for me, but go to vote to change the overall political game in the country, because the Congo has suffered a lot from the dictatorship of Denis Sassou Nguesso. He told everyone, go and vote, not for me, but for the generation to come. I think that makes me, in the same time, very sad, because someone is going to die, and the same person who's dying just gave us that legacy. It's very strong for me.
How do you think the late Guy Brice Parfait Kolela will be remembered in Congo-Brazzaville politics?
Guy Brice Parfait Kolela is a great figure in the political arena in the Congo-Brazzaville. Brice Parfait Kolela entered politics with Denis Sassou Nguesso. He has been Minister of Commerce, and he has been also minister in charge of public administration. Since 2015, Guy Brice Parfait Kolela entered opposition to Denis Sassou Nguesso.
Mr. Kolela was running a campaign in the presidential election on Sunday. Do you think the election should have been postponed?
This election should be postponed because there is an article in the Constitution, the 70th article, that says that if a candidate is seriously ill, the election has to be postponed. If a candidate just dies during the election, that election is to be postponed. So everything is clear about that. There is no doubt that this election should be postponed. Unfortunately, the government is not talking about the death of Guy Brice Parfait Kolela. It's very sad.
On Sunday, I did speak with Mr. Kolela's campaign spokesperson, Mr. Mayanda, from Brazzaville. He indicated that Mr. Kolela had been diagnosed with COVID-19. Is that what he died from?
I'm not sure about that. We have to wait a little bit to see exactly what's happened about that. We have been told about that COVID-19, but I think that the best way to do it is to ask for an autopsy for everyone to be sure of what happened to Mr. Kolela. This country has a very bad history, violent history in our country. Mr. Kolela is not the only one political figure to die in our country. There is a lot of people who passed away in that country. So I'm skeptical about this reason they are giving of the passing away of Mr. Kolela.
That was George Goma, a member of the North American Platform Against Dictatorship in Congo-Brazzaville. He was speaking with us from Quebec in Canada. Tanzanians continue to bid farewell to their fallen president, John Magufuli, who passed away last Wednesday. Today, Tuesday, the people of the semi-autonomous island of Zanzibar will pay their last respect. Yesterday, Monday, African leaders, including Uganda's Yoweri Museveni, Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, and Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa, paid their last respects in the Tanzanian capital, Dodoma. VOA Swahili language reporter Eid Uwesu is in Dodoma.
It was a difficult day for the nation of Tanzania, and even mourners from various nations gathered together for the state funeral of late John Magufuli. Crying and mourning reigned in the Jamhuri Stadium here in Dodoma, where the ceremonies took place. But in every area where the body of Magufuli was passed, the people stood on the roadside to say goodbye to Magufuli. It was a day of mourning to most of them. I talked to some of them, mainly spoke about his performance, which affecting the people's welfare, especially in managing country's resources and how he fought corruption in the country.
A number of world leaders, including African leaders, eulogized the late Magufuli, particularly in the persons of Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya, Museveni of Uganda, Ramaphosa of South Africa. What did they have to say?
James, many leaders have described Magufuli as a pan-Africanist, and that the death of Magufuli has shaken the whole of Africa. The African continent has lost a brilliant politician who fought to defend Africa and its economic resources in the interest of the Africans. They say that he became a patriot and a great lover of Tanzania. For example, President Kenyatta has stated that Magufuli showed Africans and the world that it is possible for African countries to become economically independent. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, he has described how Magufuli transferred him to Swahili and even reached the decisions to teach Kiswahili in their schools in South Africa. So each one talked about how Magufuli did a great job and left them with challenges in their performances.
President Samia Suluhu Hassan also spoke at the state funeral. What exactly did she have to say?
President Samia Suluhu Hassan, in her remarks, she described how President Magufuli gave her a platform in leadership. She also touched on the role of her presidents and said that those who think that because she's a woman, so she won't enough fit for the office, they should forget that as she continue where Magufuli has already done with more energy, and she won't let anything stop her because being a woman is not the reason that she cannot be a performing president.
Uwesu, so what's next on the final journey of the late President Magufuli? We understand the body is going to Zanzibar today, Tuesday. What can you tell us?
Yes, today people in Zanzibar will have a chance to pay their last respect, and later the body will be flown to Mwanza, where also people there will pay their last respects on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, residents of his village, Chato Geita, will have a chance to also pay their last respect before his burial ceremonies on the Friday of 26th this week, James.
That was VOA Swahili language reporter Eid Uwesu speaking with us from the Tanzanian capital, Dodoma. The UN Refugee Agency says the humanitarian crisis in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province is evolving rapidly and could negatively impact the surrounding regions if not addressed. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, two senior officials have just returned from a visit to the area.
The officials visited makeshift settlements for displaced people in Cabo Delgado. They say the insurgency, which began 4.5 years ago, is escalating rapidly and forcing increasing numbers of people to flee their homes. They report 90% of the displaced are living with family and friends in urban areas where they receive support. About 10%, they say, are unable to find refuge and are living under appalling conditions. UNHCR's Assistant High Commissioner for Protection, Gillian Triggs, says their shelters are of the most primitive kind. She says the government last distributed food to them in December. Consequently, she says people are scrounging for roots and leaves and fields to feed themselves and their families. She says she heard shocking stories from grandmothers who were caring for orphan children.
And in this case, the grandmother was caring for a baby a few months old. Her daughter had been killed in the conflict. The father of the child had been killed and beheaded. And the mother was now, or the grandmother rather, was now in this period of grief trying to care for this child without milk, where they were grinding up root vegetables for the children, giving them diarrhea and exposing them to all sorts of other things.
Trigg says the displaced in Cabo Delgado need everything, shelter, food, clothing, medical care, and protection from violence. She says there's no electricity in the makeshift settlements, and women are terrified of going out at night. More than 2,000 people have been killed since the start of the insurgency in October 2017. Triggs notes there has been a significant increase in violence in the past year.
In terms of what's actually been happening, villages have been set on fire, people killed, beheaded, including children or reports of children being beheaded, rape, and of course, huge levels of sexual violence of one kind or another. So those are the, this is a full insurgency, a conflict of a very serious kind.
The insurgency is led by militants who affiliated themselves with the Islamic State group in 2019. The UNHCR warns the current number of 700,000 internally displaced people is expected to rise to 1 million by June if this increasingly brutal conflict continues to be overlooked by the international community. The agency reports last November's $254 million appeal has received just 5%. A sum far too low to make a dent in providing the most basic of needs for people struggling to survive. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, March 23rd. Nigeria's Ministry of Education has said that the number of out-of-school children stands at 10.1 million, an increase of more than 3 million from last year. While no reason was given for the increase announced on Friday, experts point at the coronavirus pandemic and insecurities around schools. Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Abuja resident Florence Ulo is reviewing her 5-year-old son's schoolwork at home and preparing him for an upcoming term examination. When COVID-19 hit last year, Ulo, like many Nigerian parents, withdrew her child from school over fear of exposing him to the coronavirus. Even after the reopening of schools, she says she decided that he'll remain at home for some months.
When the COVID thing is started, once you contact the virus, they'll take you away. So the thought of being away from my child and being in another place and I can't have access to him was quite frightening. So I couldn't just take the risk. We had to stay back for a while.
Ulo's son recently returned to class after she said the school's precautionary measures to keep pupils safe had improved. But now, with many months out of school, he's trying to catch up.
I would go to the school and see their COVID-19 compliance level and all of that. And when I was satisfied to an extent, not like I was very comfortable about the whole thing, left for me, I wouldn't let my child go anywhere.
Nigeria's education ministry last Friday said the country has seen a jump of 3 million students out of school compared to a year ago. Even though authorities did not give reasons for the increase, the COVID-19 pandemic clearly was a factor. The Nigerian Union of Teachers, NUT, says recent attacks on schools in parts of northern Nigeria is also to blame for the increase. Emmanuel Huendi is Teachers Union spokesperson.
The bandits' attack on school have significantly kept most of our children out of school, considering that most schools are now closed down, and the desire for parents to equip their children with formal education will be on the low scale because the fears are still there. The kidnappers are on the rampage.
Around 700 students have been kidnapped from schools since December, of which scores remain in captivity. Abductions have happened at schools in Zamfara, Katsina, Jigawa, Niger, and Kaduna states. Authorities have promised to strengthen security at schools, and last week, President Muhammadu Buhari said his government will, quote, take a strong stance, end quote, against criminal gangs. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Disabled internally displaced people, IDPs, suffer disproportionately in Burkina Faso's war with local bandits, jihadist groups, and other bandits. Henry Wilkins reports from Kaya, Burkina Faso.
Disabled internally displaced people, IDPs, suffer disproportionately in Burkina Faso's war with local bandits, jihadi groups, and other terrorists. Ranchidatu Maiga and her mother, Adjaratu, fled the town of Arbinda almost 2 years ago. Adjaratu says life is very difficult because Ranchidatu can't walk. She must physically carry her wherever she goes, and it's because of that they've had to flee to Kaya. When the terrorists began killing people outside their house, Adjaratu was left with an impossible decision: endanger the whole family and stay in the house, or run with the five children who could, leaving Ranchidatu behind. The day of the attack, we ran and left her in the house, Adjaratu said. After the attack, they went back to the house. Ranchidatu had survived the terrorist raid, but Adjaratu knew they couldn't stay in the town any longer. Ranchidatu says life has improved since they arrived in Kaya, a major humanitarian hub. She says she's feeling healthy and at least they get food. The leader of the host community where the Maigas now live says he regularly sees IDPs with disabilities struggling more than others. He thinks it's good to support family members first because they're the ones who care for the disabled ultimately. He points out that support should not be purely financial either, but should extend to teaching a trade to those who are disabled. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR, says helping disabled IDPs get access to aid is a top priority. However, identifying people with disabilities is often difficult. Charles Zueki Makawaka is a UNHCR protection officer and says the organization is especially focused on accessibility to services. How people living with a disability can get that little bit of extra help getting to services. There are also the issues of stigma and discrimination that they have to deal with, sometimes even among those providing the services or within the community. Raising awareness of disabilities is crucial, he says. Because multiple UN agencies meet the needs of disabled persons, getting help can be complicated. Nonetheless, many disabled IDPs show unusual resilience in the face of the conflict. Ludovic Kabore, whose name has been changed to protect his identity, stood up to terrorists when they tried to mug him. He met with the terrorists in the street of his hometown. They told him to run away and tried to steal his phone. He just replied, "I'm not afraid of you." Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kaya, Burkina Faso.
As COVID-19 continues to halt concerts and live music events, executives at Luz Africa, a record label for Portuguese and Creole from Portuguese-speaking African countries, say their adaptation to online promotion have opened up new audience and revenue markets. Luz Africa CEO Elode De Silva spoke to Ricky Stryak about how the pandemic has actually helped them expand their market in places like Brazil.
What change we've seen is that now that we have, for example, Elida Neda, that you said, the fact that she's doing really more Afropop music, something really more for actually young people, we are actually starting to get interest from countries where it was at the beginning really difficult to work with. And I'm thinking of Brazil, for example. And for Brazilians into music coming from outside of Brazil, it's very difficult. And we've seen that with this new African Lusophone generation, they are actually starting to look at us. The other change that we've seen is that Elida Meda and Lucy Bell, all this new generation, and even other people who are not under a label like Georgie, Nelson Freitas, this new generation, they are actually talking directly to the diaspora outside of Cape Verde. And the Lusophone diaspora is huge, like it's really huge. What we've noticed is that, for example, Elida Almeida and people such as Jorge and Nelson Freitas, they are actually able to do a concert, a fully booked concert, only with people from the diaspora. And this is pretty new. This is really new to us.
Do you guys think that you will be able to kind of start to re-engage in that way at some point this year?
Well, this year with the situation, with the sanitary situation, I really don't think we will stop doing any type of concerts again. It's okay. When I say it's okay in terms of we've actually changed our entire strategy. Now we are building a really strong strategy online and we're seeing a lot of results. And when I talk about Brazil, that's one of the results we've seen with this crisis. We started to target new markets online. When I say online, it's YouTube, it's Spotify, it's Facebook ads. We started to target new markets online. So, and maybe when the concert, we will be able to go back on stage. Well, a new public, for example, in Brazil, will be huge enough to do a concert there.
Is there anything else you wanted to add about Lusophone music? And I know it's a big topic and it's kind of hard to talk about Lusophone music or Luz Africa music in a few minutes. I know there's many facets and yeah, many different ways to approach, especially depending on the musician.
But the thing that I want to really say it's important is to realize that it's always been easier for us with Lusophone music to present our work to the world outside of Africa, because the sound of Lusophone language, the sound of Portuguese in Portugal, the sound of Portuguese from Brazil, the sound of Cape Verdean music is really, I don't know how you say it in English, but it's really like a dancing sound. Like you feel like you want to dance just because of the sound of the language, which French and English, we don't have that. It's really been really helping. It's really been helping us. Our language really is really helping us.
That was Elode De Silva, CEO of Luz of Africa record label. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Paris. And that's it for this Tuesday, March 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.